Today on Peace Talks Radio, we'll explore peace and equality in the body positivity movement.
The way that we view comparison now in our culture comes from this very deficit-based comparison. When we look at comparison from an abundant perspective, we're able to see the differences, the nuances, and in some ways seeing ourselves as a reflection of that other person through that shared sense of beauty.
We'll hear how our beauty standards can be exclusionary and unrealistic.
There was this bright red blazer that I really wanted, and they only had a size 42, and I asked for a size 48, and she was like, no, we don't have that size. So I just asked her, can you look online, or maybe I could get it from another store? And she was like, well, maybe you're just too fat to shop here.
Ideas about honoring all bodies today on Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, today with correspondent Julia Joubert. For centuries, humans have placed significant importance on beauty, being fit, being healthy. Society, and more so in recent decades, media and pop culture, have often shaped these views and set the standards by which we compare ourselves to those standards and to each other. In today's program, we will hear two firsthand experiences, one from Kate Navarrete, a 19-year-old second-generation Cuban-American. Kate is the founder and executive director of Body Positive Alliance, a student-led nonprofit organization advocating for the acceptance and representation of all bodies. And we'll also hear from author and men's style and body positivity influencer, Kelvin Davis. We'll also be turning to Alicia McCullough, a licensed clinical mental health therapist and founder of Black and Embodied Consulting, PLLC. In part two of our program, we will dig into the body positivity movement. We'll explore where it came from, how it can be more inclusive and intersectional in its approach, and address the health concerns around celebrating larger bodies. We'll begin today's conversation with licensed clinical mental health therapist Alicia McCullough. Julia Joubert asked, how would one define body image and what does it encompass?
Yeah, so when I think about body image, it really brings me to how do we experience ourselves in totality? And so I think that body image looks like both our internal experience of ourselves, and so how are we feeling, for example, safe in our bodies? How do we view our bodies in general? When we are moving around the world, how safe do we feel within our bodies? And so I think there's the internal, and then I also think there's the external, so the way that the world views our bodies, and then there's different perceptions that have been placed on our bodies due to those world ideas. And I think all of that goes into how we see our body and how we show up and experience autonomy, safety, belonging, and dignity within ourselves.
Both Kate and Kelvin work extensively to advocate not only for their own bodies, but for the acceptance and representation of all bodies. So I wanted to go back to the beginning and ask, what was the history of their relationship with body image like?
I can remember struggling with body image as young as 5 years old. I, growing up, was a competitive athlete. I was a swimmer all my life, which I always think is important to highlight when I talk about where my body image issues came from. And so growing up, I was a very traditionally healthy kid, lived an active lifestyle, didn't think too much about food or exercise. It was always just kind of something that I am very grateful to say that I had access to. And then as I got older and entered middle school and started going through puberty, I noticed that my body was changing a lot, and it changed a lot faster than I could mentally keep up with. And I think that this, compiled with the fact that during my last year of middle school, I was forced to wear a back brace for my scoliosis, which caused a lot of muscle atrophy, definitely instilled this idea that my body was not good enough and that it had failed in some way and failed me by not living up to the beauty standard that I set for myself. And so at this time, I also noticed that as a girl who's going through puberty, your athletic performance sometimes diminishes. And this is an unfortunate thing that happens to a lot of young girls, a sad reason why a lot of young girls stop playing sports. But I definitely was a victim of that mentality and that that mindset. And so when I started high school, I developed two eating disorders, binge eating disorder and orthorexia. You could also describe something like that as I was experiencing as anorexic tendencies or bulimia without purging. So just compensatory behaviors. It was this struggle that caused me to quit my sport eventually. It was also the struggle, though, that inspired me to be so passionate about alleviating body image concerns for myself and my peers, and ultimately led me to start a club at my high school, which later turned into my nonprofit organization.
You know, I was fortunate enough to grow up in a pretty body positive family because I have a mother that's, you know, heavier set. And, you know, I feel like just within the Black community, especially with women, it's very normal for women of like the African-American culture to have curves and to be bigger and to have stretch marks on their hips and their, you know, stomachs and all that stuff. So for me, seeing all that stuff wasn't foreign. But from the societal standpoint, especially since I was born in 1987, I was raised in the 90s. The way that I grew up, it was like, not only was a certain body type more beautiful, but a certain skin tone was more beautiful. It was like, if you're a lighter skin and you're Black, you're like beautiful, right? But it's like being darker skin and being chubby and being like kind of short was, you know, all those factors of like, you're not beautiful in like a societal standpoint. So for me, it was the fact of trying to understand, how do I feel so comfortable with my family, but when I leave this bubble and go outside and go to work or go to school, I feel so insecure.
In spite of the mostly supportive home environments that both Kate and Colvin grew up in, both of them experienced levels of body dissatisfaction. So I wanted to find out from Alicia, how are larger societal systems potentially influencing the way that we see our bodies?
When we look at systems, they're the things that tell us how we are existing in the world. They're the ones that give us access to different advantages or disadvantages in the world. And so when I think about, for example, systems of colonialism or patriarchy or supremacy, those are different systems that have been established that determine how safe we feel in our body. So for example, due to the system of patriarchy, oftentimes as a woman, I might not experience the world in the same way as my male counterparts. I've personally been impacted by a few of the systems, but the one that I think about is I am a Black woman. And so specifically being Black, the experience of, for example, white supremacy and this idea that white is the standard in our culture has impacted the way that I exist in my body, because if whiteness is the standard and our society has been structured around that whiteness, then my existence as Blackness is considered as deviant. Because of this default, there's this constant questioning of myself around, you know, is this space affirming for me? Is this space safe for me? Will I be accepted? And that's something I think that I've had to contend with within my identity, just being someone who does hold that Black identity.
For Kate, external factors like the community she grew up in had a huge influence on her individual body image and also the way in which she viewed and treated other bodies.
I definitely grew up not surrounded by diversity externally. And I think that that made me very uncomfortable, not necessarily with people of other races, but people of other body sizes. You know, from a young age, I was taught to respect people regardless of their race or their background or their identity. But something that was never included in there as one of those factors was body size, because a larger body was deemed as not only unattractive and unhealthy, but also of a lower status. Being from a Hispanic family, having family members of a multitude of races and ethnicities and backgrounds and identities was something that I was exposed to in my home, but not necessarily taught to understand in a school or peer setting. And so because of that, when you go to school and you spend the majority of your time there as a kid, one becomes the dominating mindset as opposed to the other. And so for me, I felt much more susceptible to my peer environment, and becoming an athlete, and the sport of swimming especially, is a very homogenous sport as well. And so because of that, it perpetuated and fueled a lot of narratives consistently about body size and athleticism and health that were confirmed by my peer environment. And so I definitely would pass judgment, not necessarily vocally, but internally at least.
Mm. I find it very interesting in that similarly, I was also a swimmer and I can viscerally remember the kind of like standing on the poolside, comparing myself to my peers without really wanting to, but it's a, and this is a moment of vulnerability, but you know, you say that thing of like, not with judgment, but kind of with judgment. And I think a lot of the time I was making comparisons mentally in that, okay, well, society says that I'm better than this person, but I'm worse than this person.
Right.
Purely because of how they look. I don't know who this person is. I just know that I am better than them because I'm not as big as them. And I am worse than them because I am bigger than them. And so growing up, really struggled with that link between your body image and your value or your worth. And I just wanted to clarify there, were you kind of expressing that there was that for you in terms of your value and how you looked were very much interlinked?
100%. And I think what I talked about previously of my family validating my appearance and never instilling any negative body image in me was a double-edged sword, right? I think it's important for parents to instill positive self-esteem in their child, but at the same time, especially for a young girl, doing so on the basis of her appearance is, it's problematic for a number of reasons. And I think one of the largest ones is that the frequency of appearance validation can be, in a lot of ways, internally fulfilling, but it also, once again, perpetuates that idea that your worth is linked to your appearance. And so for me, having this happen at such a young age and then my body changing, I suddenly felt like my worth was now diminished because I didn't look the way I previously had when I was receiving validation. You could argue that part of that was the amount of validation that society was giving me, because society tends to validate people who are smaller more than people who are larger. But at the same time, I think to some extent, I really, really wanted other people's approval on the way that I looked. We all want validation and we all want to feel like we're worthy. Women are given more privileges when they are found to be conventionally attractive. So it makes sense that so many women tie their worth as a person to their physical appearance, because that's what we're taught to do. And so experiencing this at a young age, being considered conventionally attractive, and then growing up and somehow feeling like I was getting farther away from that, I felt like I was losing some amount of power in society.
Earlier, Colvin shared that having darker skin, and in his words, being chubby and short, meant that he believed he was not beautiful from a societal standpoint. And similarly to Kate, began to first experience this while in high school.
In high school, I was tired of wearing glasses and I wanted some contacts. And I remember when I went to go get them, I asked my mother, could I have colored contacts? Because people thought like colored eyes were like so beautiful. And I remember my mom being like, okay, yeah, sure. Like she was kind of confused. But for me, it was me trying to equate or me trying to be something that I'm not. Because obviously my eyes are brown naturally, but I wanted to get colored contacts. So it made me look and feel more beautiful to like the people that I was around. And there were moments of, I felt like inferior to, you know, the people around me, because you have these people that are quote unquote the definition of societal beauty at that time. Obviously, you know, being like a young teenage boy, like not only do you want to fit in, but you want to be attractive to the people that you are attracted to. With me, it was like that struggle of how do I get these girls I'm attracted to be attracted to me? And that's when I think the eating started to change a little bit. Like I would, you know, eat a little bit less. I would like replace a lunch with like water, and I would like exercise a lot. I put colored contacts in. I was basically just trying to be something that I wasn't. And then this is sad to say, but I'm glad I didn't find out about skin bleaching then. Because when you get older, you know, you can't really erase that. It's really like scary that there's so many people out there that are still so insecure with not only their bodies, but with, when I talk about body positivity, I feel like a lot of people forget that the biggest part of my body is my skin tone. Like, before somebody sees the fact that I'm bigger or that I'm this or I'm that, the first thing that they notice is that I'm Black and I'm a male. But it's like, those are the first two things that anybody, from a societal standpoint, when they see me, that's what they first notice.
What was the conversation like around your body when you were in these kind of like early teenage years? What were the conversations like, and what was the language like about your body and other bodies at that time?
I feel like the male perspective and the female perspective are two different things. Like, you know, with my friends that were girls, I feel like when they would say certain things, it hurt a lot more. With my female friends, or like with girls that I was attracted to, maybe like trying to like get them to date me, when they would say certain things, or when I would ask for advice, or when I would confide to them, their opinions meant a little bit more to me. Like, I had this girl who I had a huge crush on. Her name was Amanda in the sixth grade. I like wrote her like a letter. And I basically like confessed my undying teenage love for her. And she wrote me back and she said, "I don't date guys that shop in the Huskies section." So back in this time, there was a Husky section for teenage boys that were too big to fit in like kids' clothes, but they were too small to fit in men's clothes. But my mother had this way of making it feel like this inclusive kind of like club of like, you're special, you only get to shop here because you're special, right? But at school, it was like, nah, you fat. You shop in the Husky section? That's crazy. Like, when she told me that, I remember like I remember my feelings being hurt.
Clearly, the language that we use when speaking about ourselves and other people has a huge impact. I wanted to know from Alicia and from Kate how they believed we are knowingly or unknowingly contributing to suffering by the way that we talk about other people's bodies.
Yeah, this is a wonderful question. And I get this a lot when working with different clients. And so, for example, let's say you're a parent, you're on a diet, and you're constantly critiquing your body. You're like, I have to lose weight. Oh, I don't look good. This outfit doesn't fit right on my body. Do I look thin in these pants? Those type of comments, your kids are hearing that and they're picking up on it. And so then when they're looking at themselves, they're internalizing that messaging from you and saying, oh, do I look good in my body? Does my dress fit okay? Do my pants fit okay? And so that's one way that we directly pass down some of that fat phobia and body dissatisfaction to our children. I would also say, even when you're with friends, if you're saying things like, oh, I've gained so much weight, or you're at some type of brunch or outing and you're like going over the menu saying, I can't eat this. This is a bad food, or this is not like a healthy option. Those are comments that, while they might seem very innocent, they might seem very much like, well, I'm just talking about my own experience. You have to think about how those are coming across to other people around you. And so, for example, when you're asking the question of, I'm gaining weight, what about your friend who actually is a higher weight than you? And when you're saying that, how are they experiencing that comment as someone who is in a larger body and hearing you talk about your weight in such a negative way? Or if you're at the dinner and you're talking about what you're eating, what about for the friend who perhaps is eating, you know, what they want and they're feeling pleasureful in their food, but they're seeing you critique and judge yourself? Now they're feeling like, maybe you're critiquing and judging me too. So I think there are these ways in which we've become normalized to talking about ourselves. We normalize saying things like, I just need to lose a little bit of weight after I eat. You know, I'm going to go for a walk just to take off the pounds. As if the body works in this very mechanical way of food in, food out. I think our bodies are a lot more complex than that. But I just think we have to be more mindful of the ways that we talk about our bodies to be more affirming.
I always think of the one scene in Mean Girls where all the girls are pointing out something they don't like about their appearance. And then Katie, who's not from the US or just hasn't grown up in this body conscious environment, is, you know, then turned to and doesn't have anything to say and kind of makes up this weird response. And that to me is such a, I wouldn't necessarily say accurate, but it's just, it's kind of a hyperbolized representation of the way that young women and women as a whole, women, I've, you know, my mom's friends, whatever it is, talk about their bodies. And I definitely noticed this in a peer group setting. That was something I struggled with a lot in high school. And I think when I went through recovery, I was very open about the fact that I was going through recovery. And because of that, a lot of people in my life, thankfully so, respected my boundaries in a way where they just stopped talking about it or didn't make comments on themselves or others. But I have noticed, you know, whether it's people in my family making comments about their bodies or people in my peer group setting now at university, having those thoughts is contagious. You bring it up and then someone else thinks, should I be worried about that? Or especially if you have a friend who, you know, whether they look similar or dissimilar to you, if they comment on something about their appearance and they say, I don't like my nose or I don't like my hips. What if you all have the same nose? What if you all have the same hips? Then what does that the person next to you feel about their body? So I think, again, avoiding talk about I like this part or I dislike this part of my body is really important. I believe that there are productive ways to have conversations about body image without being triggering toward others. But at the same time, I think singling out those parts of your body and having conversations about your appearance is 99% of the time more unhelpful than helpful.
I'd like to move now into social media, if I may, and talk about how we are engaging with our bodies and other bodies in that space. So as we're learning about the impact that language from our parents, peers, and community influences us, I wanted to know, what role do you think social media plays?
Social media is a big one. I've been in situations where the nicest people in my life are scrolling through social media, and I've heard them say some nasty things about people on social media. Like, I've seen people that I know look at girls on social media and say, oh, why did they post that? They don't look good in that. Like, just comments like that, where I think people, that obviously is coming from a place of personal insecurity, but it's that commentary that's just fueled by a system like social media, which is completely intended to be superficial. And so when you've got people trapped in a superficial cyclone, they're gonna start to make judgments about people to calm down their own insecurity. And also just because there's not really much else to do, right? You either say, oh, I wish I looked like that, or you're criticizing how that looks. There's not many situations where you're looking at social media and thinking to yourself, wow, I'm so happy for them. That looks awesome. And I'm completely content with my life looking at that. It's usually one or the other. It's usually the comparison or the put down. And so that's definitely something that I've noticed.
Alicia shared that while social media is a powerful tool, she reminds us that we do actually have some agency to determine what we see.
When we're liking content, for example, if someone's posting a before and after picture, if we like that picture, then social media algorithm is going to say, oh, they must want to see weight loss pictures. So then they're going to give us another one. Or if we're liking pictures of people consistently saying, I'm trying this new diet or this new cleanse or this new weight loss supplement, the algorithm is going to pick that up and say, they want more of this. And so one of the things I think about is, as consumers, how are we structuring the algorithm to offer us more affirming content? Now, I do want to be mindful also that we do have a dominant narrative of the Eurocentric beauty standards that are, we'll say, overlaying the landscape of social media. And so it does take that intentional usage to say, actually, I do want to see more influencers who are Black, who exist in larger bodies, who have disabilities, who are talking about food in affirming ways. So it can take that more intentional effort. However, I think a lot of times we're just consuming media and not being as mindful about how we're altering our algorithm to best serve the needs that we have in the moment. And so I do want to name that, because we have a culture that does push the thin ideal, the slim thick ideal, but we also have this other side that is more inclusive to that diversity, to that inclusion on social media.
Mm-hmm. So What I see, for example, online is, as you mentioned, I see a lot of the skinny thick, and I see a lot of the classic, this is my 9 a.m. body, this is also my 9 a.m. body. And I look at it and I can kind of appreciate it for what it is and what it is trying to be right now. But it still seems to create an atmosphere of comparison. And I spoke to Kate quite a bit about this as well, is that by consuming all of this, I am still inherently comparing myself and saying, okay, well, you know, I'm not as big as this person, but I'm not as thin as this person. And I do have roles like that, but not quite like that. Am I supposed to be looking like that? So what does that mean when I know, for example, that images are hyper-edited or photoshopped, or I know that there are so many different bodies and therefore my body should be valid, yet I am still affected by it so much. Why am I still impacted by it as much as I am? And to follow on from that, and I'm hoping you can help me here, is then how do I better filter this messaging so that it doesn't affect me as much as it does?
That's a wonderful question. I want to really normalize that comparison is a superhuman experience, firstly, and also say that I think that the way that we view comparison now in our culture comes from this very deficit-based comparison versus this abundance-based comparison. When we look at comparison from an abundant perspective, we're able to see the differences, the nuances, the beauty in other people and celebrate that while also seeing it in ourselves. And in some ways, seeing ourselves as a reflection of that other person through that shared sense of beauty and our individuality, and how that all comes together to create this human experience. When we're looking at it from a deficit base, we're solely looking at, I don't measure up, I'm missing something, I need to change, I need to alter. And so it reminds me, for example, when engaging social media, the filters. And so while we might cognitively know my friend is using a filter, my family, the celebrity, because the goal of media is to keep us on for as long as possible in the hopes that we'll buy something, we're often quickly just consuming picture, reel, story so quickly and rapidly that our mind is not actually taking the time to consciously process what we're taking in. And so for us, as we're seeing the filters, we're just seeing it and we're like, that's real. They look so good. And then we're feeling like, oh, I must go and alter my appearance to get that. And so that's why we do now have a culture where kids, teenagers are asking their parents, can I get fillers? Can I get Botox? At such young ages, and the brain development is not there to say, actually, this is like a curated AI imaging, a type of product that's being put onto this real person. And so one of the ways I think that we can combat that is firstly setting time limits around the time we're on social media. So even if it's like, I'm going to set a time limit for 30 minutes and then take a break, experience something else, give your eyes like a reset, and then come back. It can also look like if you're able to intentionally engage in your content and then pulling back and saying, how am I feeling by consuming this picture? Like, what are the thoughts that are happening for me as I'm looking at this picture of this person? What am I feeling in my body? What sensations and impulses do I have as I'm taking in this content? And if that means you're journaling about it, you're talking to a friend, you're just taking that mental note, even that little pause can offer space for us to really reshape the way that we're thinking about this experience of being online.
That was licensed therapist Alicia McCullough. We'll have part two of Julia Joubert's Peace Talks radio program on peace and equality and body image after this upcoming short break. Thank you. This is Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, today with correspondent Julia Joubert. And this is part two of our program on peace and equality in body image. Previously, we heard from Kate Navarrete, a 19-year-old advocating for the acceptance and representation of all bodies. Also, we heard from Kelvin Davis, a Black man and father of two, working to inspire men to be confident in their bodies. Our guests in part one shared their personal stories of body image, the role that their communities played in how they saw themselves, and the role that language and social media played in maintaining sometimes harmful views. We also heard from Alicia McCullough, a licensed clinical mental health therapist, about the way that beyond what society says, critiquing our own bodies inadvertently affects how others see themselves. She also shared her views about how the structural system influencing body image disproportionately affect Black people and minority groups more than others. In part two of this program, we'll be taking a look at the body positivity movement. We'll explore where it came from, whether people are equally represented in the movement, and if there is any validity to the health concerns around celebrating larger bodies. We also hear from our guests about how they came to have their own positive body image. We'll begin with more from Alicia McCullough. Julia Joubert looks to understand where and how the body positivity movement actually came to be.
So the body positivity movement is a movement that was influenced by fat liberation. The fat liberation movement actually started in the 70s and 80s by fat women to discuss their experiences of discrimination, prejudice, and bias that they were experiencing in their body through the medical field, their jobs, within the home. Now, I do want to be clear and say that body positivity in general is a movement that was started by fat, Black, queer, trans, disabled women and people. However, over time, what has happened is that the movement has become co-opted. And so now we do see this representation of mostly thin, white, able-bodied women at the forefront of body positivity. But I do want to be clear that that's actually not where it originally started, but that those folks who experience marginalization have been pushed to the margins and have been ostracized within this movement of body positivity.
We're coming there to the intersectionality of it. And before I ask you whether you consider the movement today intersectional, I'd first love to hear, could you please explain intersectionality?
Yeah. So intersectionality is a term coined by Kimberly Crenshaw. And the term really refers to the ways in which we experience disadvantage or advantage and how those can be compounded based on our identities. And so intersectionality really talks about that place where you're holding those multiple identities within yourself and you're saying, I belong in each world, but at the same time, for example, the women's rights movement, you know, was excluding Black women. And then oftentimes, even within the Black power movement, there was a lot of patriarchy and Black men at the front. And so sometimes Black women felt excluded from those areas as well because of their womanhood. And so this intersectionality piece really holds the places in which we have intersecting identities of privilege or of marginalization, and then how that shows up in our society and how oftentimes folks with those intersectional identities are often invisible in a lot of these movement spaces.
Mm. You mentioned there Black women, white women, Black men. From my understanding, intersectionality has a kind of broadened. What other factors should we be considering when we speak about being intersectional?
Of course, absolutely. And so when we think about intersectionality, some things to consider are gender, race, class, socioeconomic status, religion, whether our citizenship, ability, sexual orientation, gender identity. So those are just a few ways that we can view intersectionality. And so, for example, when we talk about intersectionality, I think about the experience of someone who, for example, might be white, gay, and male is going to be different from the experience of someone who identifies as white, straight, and male. Or someone who identifies as a trans Black woman is going to be different than someone who identifies as a cisgendered Black woman because of the way that those intersections show up. And so I do want to say that not only is it important to acknowledge the places where we do hold that oppression, but it's also important to notice the places where we hold privilege, because those are spaces that we can create more possibilities for folks that don't have access in the ways that we do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to come to the intersectionality within the body positivity community and in the movement, you alluded a little bit to how it's able-bodied, white, relatively thin women who are leading this now, which is very different to how it started. So I think I already know your answer here in terms of, would you consider today's version of body positivity intersectional? But I'd love to hear in your own words, do you? And if not, why not?
Yeah. So I think when we talk about body positivity or see representation of body positivity now, it is mostly thin, white, able-bodied women who are on social media or on some other larger platform saying things like, it's okay to have a body roll. It's okay to have cellulite. It's okay to have stretch marks. And while those things do have a place, and I think that it can be inspirational for a lot of folks who've never been told that before, I think that for folks who don't see themselves in that message, it continues to leave them isolated to say, well, is it okay, for example, for me to be in a wheelchair? Is it okay for me to need assistance? Is it okay for me to have the skin tone that I have, or to have some other type of physical presentation that doesn't align with this specific image? I think that it really leaves out those folks. And so what I love body positivity to do is really expand on the way that it shows representation. I would also like to see this reorientation and understanding that body positivity did start with folks who experienced marginalization. And so I think that credit needs to be given back to those folks who did sacrifice sometimes their careers, their livelihood, in order to create this movement for us to all show up in now and feel comfortable to exist in the variety of shapes, sizes, and weights that we do.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much human variation. I think that's such a beautiful experience to be able to witness and be a part of the myriad of ways that we exist. And so I do see that on my page. And I think we're talking more systemically that overall, we are seeing mostly white, thin, able-bodied people at the forefront of the magazines, of the modeling agencies. And then when these modeling agencies or, you know, magazines or other entertainment media does try to expand that representation, oftentimes they're looking at who's safer to put at the forefront. So, for example, that might be, we're going to put a fat white woman who has more of a pear-sized or pear-shaped body that's more sexualized or desirable at the forefront of this magazine. Or if we do decide to use a person of color, we're going to go with the person who's the lightest skin, with the, you know, looser hair texture, with the thinner features, because that's what's more in proximity to whiteness or Eurocentric beauty standards. And so I think that, you know, even when they're trying to expand, they're still saying, what's safe enough for white culture? And we're not seeing a lot of the more darker skin, maybe body sizes that are not super proportional in shape, people that have acne, older people, you know, that may have wrinkles or things like that. We're not seeing that type of representation in the media. And often, even in talking to some folks who get lifted up in that way, they're like, yeah, I was underpaid, you know, for that opportunity, or I was made to feel like I had to just be grateful that I was even being, you know, invited to the table. And so there's still like a different energy for folks that even get those opportunities than for other folks. They're getting paid, you know, what they desire, and they're feeling like they're, you know, in the right conversations. They're meeting other people that are advancing them to the next level or to the next opportunity. And so that is something that I often do hear, unfortunately. For folks who do finally get that seat at the table, they say, I honestly just feel exploited.
Colvin believes that the men's movement is scattered.
I feel like the body positivity movement for men right now, especially on the internet, I feel like it's very scattered.
Okay.
I feel like there's not a definitive marker. I feel like with the women's movement, there's like certain accounts, there's a certain aesthetic, there's a certain, you know, it's very definitive. I feel like with the men's, it's all over the place. I feel like that's why maybe the men's movement is so hard to progressively move forward, is because you have like such hyper-masculinity and such non-hyper-masculinity. There's like no middle ground. It's either or. The body positivity movement for men, I feel like there's not enough of us.
Mm.
I don't know, you know, how much research you did, but I feel like even when you search And when you found me, I wonder, like, how many other people did you find, like, in the men's space? Like, did you find any more?
I think, you know, if we're being honest, the list I found you on, you were one of eight.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to think about, we have eight, maybe, I mean, especially in the prominent space of, like, social media and places where people can really get the knowledge that they need. We're talking about, like, maybe less than 10 people that are spreading this message about body positivity for men.
Kate has similar concerns to Alicia when it comes to the body positivity movement, and highlights body neutrality as a possible response to the failings of the movement.
I totally want to start by validating the people who take the time to combat harmful body standards in general as a whole, whether it is through body positivity or body neutrality. I think that body neutrality was created as a response to where body positivity may have failed people. I personally do not see body positivity as individually ideological. I see it as a socio-political movement. What I think body positivity in the mainstream gets wrong is that it's about loving your body all the time. And I think that's where body neutrality comes in as a response to say, no, don't think about your body. Your body is good enough regardless of what it looks like, or prioritize what your body can do for you. And so I think on one end, there may be some ableism in body neutrality. I don't necessarily think it's intentional, but it just kind of comes up. And so where I would love to see body positivity go is to prioritize the concerns of women of color, to prioritize the concerns of disabled people and trans and non-binary people and everyone else who has been affected by some form of body oppression. And right now, that is how I define body positivity. And I would love to see that pushed more into the mainstream, because I do think that ultimately it is a socio-political movement. It is not an individual ideology. I think that if we can relieve the concerns of the most marginalized people, it will have a ripple effect, and body image for everyone will be more positive as a result.
One of the most prevalent conversations that comes up alongside body image is the conversation around weight, and especially around the weight value connection in society today, where if you're larger, you're potentially seen as lesser than. You know, society says that weight is a marker for health. If you're fat, then you're unhealthy. If you're fat, you're lazy and you don't have discipline. So I wanted to hear from Alicia. Could she explain that weight value connection that we see in society today?
Yes. So first, I want to affirm that the weight value marker is a real thing, and it shows up in the body mass index, also known as the BMI. And so when thinking about the BMI, it was actually influenced by a mathematician named Adolphe Quetelet, who in the 1830s, he really wanted to measure what is the average height to weight ratio of the average man. And so it was just some like random experiment that he just wanted to discover and research, and particularly was looking at white men in the 1830s. Well, then our healthcare system picked up on this instrument and decided we'll just incorporate it into the healthcare system as a way to measure health. There is also this idea through the public health system that an insurance system that, okay, if we adopt this BMI scale, now we can charge people these insurance premiums based on their weight, and saying we're going to use that as a predeterminant of how healthy you are. And so I want to be clear with folks and say that weight is not an accurate measure of health. It was never intended to be. Adolphe Quetelet was not a healthcare provider or a researcher or a scientist. He was a mathematician and astronomer. And so when I personally think about health, for example, I think about it being connected to having access to clean water, to clean air, to living in a safe neighborhood, to quality food, to have an environment where you don't experience as much stress in your body, which stress is a precursor for inflammation, which we know inflammation is the root of most disease. And so those are the ways in which I think we can expand out what health is outside of just looking at a number on the scale, which does not account for muscle mass or hormonal changes or things like that. So I just want to let folks know your worth is not tied to a number on the scale.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm Julia Joubert, and in today's program, we are discussing peace and equality in the body positivity movement. Our guests are Kate Navarrete, a 19-year-old second-generation Cuban-American and founder and executive director of Body Positive Alliance, a student-led nonprofit organization advocating for the acceptance and representation of all bodies. She also hosts the Generation Body Positive podcast. We also speak with Culvin Davis, author and men's style and body positivity influencer, with the blog Notoriously Dapper, How to Be a Modern Gentleman with Manners, Style, and Body Confidence. And Alicia McCullough. Alicia is a licensed clinical mental health therapist and founder of Black and Embodied Consulting, PLLC. Alicia specializes in eating disorder treatment with a focus on amplifying the values of body justice and fat liberation within queer, trans, Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. They join us today to talk about their own body image, how larger systems contribute to body dissatisfaction, the role that language plays, and if the body positivity movement does need improving, how do we truly honor all bodies? Now back to our conversation. How can we overcome these societal influences? How can parents, for example, better support their children to live these healthy lives while loving their bodies?
That is a really great question. And so first, I just want to validate the concerns of parents, because it is a hard time that we're living in where kids' bodies are being constantly under scrutiny. And there are research studies showing that even as young as 5-6 years old, children are worried about their weight and they're attempting to lose weight at such young ages. It is a really hard time for parents at this moment. And I really want to hold space for that. And also name that we can talk to our children and talk to the youth around really starting to develop a awareness of their bodies in a more holistic way. And by that, what I mean is asking them about, how do you feel in your body today? And even at a young age, asking, do you feel good in your body? Even when they eat a certain food, how does that food feel in your body? Is your tummy hurting? Are you noticing that you're feeling more tired? And so it really starts to develop this internal awareness for the child and for the youth. Is this something that, you know, is affirming for me and brings me joy and pleasure? You know, those are the type of conversations that I would love to hear. And I think too, and it can be a little bit more work on the parent, but even when you're going to your medical providers, pushing back about being weighed in the BMI, you can advocate for yourself and say, I choose not to be weighed. You can ask, is it medically necessary for me to be weighed in this time or for my child to be weighed in this time? And I will say too, just in the household, perhaps setting a precedence of, we don't shame or stigmatize weight. We talk about it as if it's neutral, because it is. And we have those conversations of, yes, some people have small bodies. Some people have larger bodies. That's just a part of us existing in our diverse iterations of human existence. And so even normalizing those conversations from a young age can serve as a protector for kids as they're moving out in the world, where we know they're going to be inundated with those constant diet fatphobic messages from society. And then the work that I would really invite folks to do is to go inward and really examine your own biases. We all have been infected by this culture of fatphobia. And so it's not if we have fatphobic beliefs, it's when do they show up more so. And I say that even for myself, as someone who studied this work, who is a mental health therapist, who works in eating disorders, who works alongside colleagues in the fat liberation spaces, that even for me, being a part of this culture, I've been indoctrinated with fat phobia. And so I have to constantly even go within myself and say, when I'm critiquing my belly, when I am critiquing something that I'm eating, where is that critique coming from? And really come at it and approach it with compassion and care around, I've internalized this belief about myself. Does this belief serve me? Who is this belief serving? And then replacing that belief with something that feels more affirming.
For Calvin, it was also a journey to be more affirming with his body.
I had still one of my best friends from college. He used to always tell me, people are too busy thinking about themselves to be thinking about you. And it didn't really make sense to me until I got, honestly, to about maybe my mid-20s when I realized that so many people are literally consumed with how they look and how they feel about their bodies that they're not worried about how you feel or how you look about in your body. And that was a big change for me too, because it lowers the pressure of you having to worry about how you feel based off of what society thinks and what other people think.
I do think it is very difficult for people to, even when they hear those words of no one's looking at you, everybody is unique, love your own body. It's one thing to hear those words and another thing entirely to actually believe them.
Yes.
What did you do to get to that point? Because I think
I think
that's where we're really needing some help.
Of course. I did have one of those experiences, and that's what led me to start this blog, was when I graduated from college and I went to go shopping and I went to go get this red blazer, and the sales associate told me that I was too fat to shop there. Now, that was an experience where your like biggest fear has been met with like the insecurity that you felt. Because you go on in life thinking that like, you know, yeah, like nobody cares about what I look like, da-da-da. Everybody's too worried about themselves. But then I had that moment, and I remember I had just graduated from college. I was getting some newer clothes because I wanted to be stylish. And, you know, there was this bright red blazer that I really wanted. And they only had a size 42. And I asked for a size 48. And she was like, no, we don't have that size. So I just asked her, you know, can you look online? Or maybe I could get it from another store. And she was like, well, maybe you're just too fat to shop here. Those were her exact words. Now, mind you, you know, I am in my 20s. And I had just had my first child. So everything to me was very, like, vulnerable. You know, I was a brand new father. I was, you know, trying to use the college education that my parents had paid for to do something with my life. And I felt like this overwhelming sense of insecurity for a long time. Now, this is the first time in my life for a long time I felt very insecure, because it was the first time where that biggest fear, like I said, of when you feel insecure, but then nobody says anything to you, you're like, nobody's really worried about me. But when you have that one time when somebody says it, it hurts so different. I feel like, you know, whenever that happened, I could have went in two separate ways. I could have gone down this rabbit hole of like sadness, which I did for a little bit. Or you could try to understand that you can't control people, and how they feel about you has nothing to do with the way that you should feel about yourself, and that you kind of got to pull yourself out of the mud and keep it pushing. And that's how I started this blog. And that's why it started off as like a body positive menswear blog, was because I wanted other men that maybe felt insecure to know that they weren't alone. It was like a way of me like discreetly talking about insecurities and body image through the lens of fashion, and making men feel better about themselves by giving them advice about how to dress better and how to dress for their body types.
In an episode of her podcast, Generation Body Positive, Kate expressed that she often found herself able to preach self-love, anti-diet culture, and self-acceptance, but would struggle to actually absorb the messages herself. So to close out this program, I wanted to know from her, how would she advise somebody to push through that barrier and get to a point where they actually hold a positive body image and begin to heal?
That's a great question. And I've said that obviously, but that was something that I struggled with really early on in the creation of my organization, or the club specifically before that. I was still dealing with my issues with food and body image at that point. And I think that's something that really pushed me to recover is one sentence, and it was one question, and I asked myself it: do I want to feel like this for the rest of my life? And that question was something that motivated me throughout my entire recovery and motivates me to this day to stay with it. I will not say that I have not struggled since I entered recovery. There were a few really great years where I felt mostly on top of the world. And that was because at least for a couple of hours every day, I was putting in an insane amount of effort to make sure that I felt okay with my body and with food. And sometimes life happens. I've been incredibly busy this school year and my anxiety has picked up. And I know that my relationship with food is very much connected to my anxiety as someone who struggles with that. And so I have struggled with body image a lot more this semester than I have in the past 4 years, honestly. And so that's something that I recognize is constantly fluctuating, but I always remind myself of, I deserve to live a life where I am happy with my body, where I'm comfortable with my relationship with food, where I get to enjoy a meal with my friends, spontaneous ice cream runs, travel to different places and trying things as a part of new cultures, engaging in joyful movement. I deserve to live a life without disordered eating because I don't have the brain space for disordered eating right now. That's something that my nutritionist would tell me in recovery. You're a busy person. You have a lot of stuff going on in your life. This is a distraction, right? This is anxiety trying to tell you that you need to do this in order to feel good, when in reality, it's preventing you from being whole. And I just think to myself, how much better of a friend I am, how much better of a partner I am, how much better of a family member I am when I am nourished, when I am able to engage in joyful movement. And, you know, think about it as something that you deserve individually, but it also, if you can't do that yet, think about it, how it may affect other people, right? Like, I know that people in your life can be really great motivators for recovery. And, you know, I don't want to be on my deathbed worrying about my relationship with food or my body. That just sounds like such a horrible thing to have to go through. And I want to say that I lived a full life. And I think that for me, a huge part of that is being liberated from that.
That was Kate Navarrete with her closing sentiments. Kate is the founder and executive director of Body Positive Alliance, a student-led nonprofit organization advocating for the acceptance and representation of all bodies. She believes we all deserve to live a life where we are happy with our bodies, where we have a comfortable relationship with food, where we get to engage in joyful movement, and where we get to feel liberated from external ideas of what a beautiful body is. You can find Kate's full interview with Julia and all the complete interviews with Kelvin and Alicia at peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can go to hear all the programs in our series dating back to 2002. You can see photos of our guests there, you can read and share transcripts, sign up for our podcast, and importantly, make a donation to keep this program going into the future. You can help our nonprofit work at peacetalksradio.com. Because support does come from listeners like you, but also some from the Albuquerque Community Foundation Ties Fund. Nola Daves Moses is the executive director of our nonprofit organization. Jessica Tickton is our supervising producer. Allie Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For our co-founder, Suzanne Kreider, for correspondent Julia Joubert, and the rest of our team, I'm Paul Ingles. Thanks so much for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.